From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. There are plenty of great public colleges like UCLA. They used to be much cheaper than equally strong private colleges. But now the price of many public colleges is rising fast, and that leaves some high school students with little or no choice for higher education, including African American students. So what options do you have if you want to get an education but don't want to run up years' worth of student loans? We'll ask economist and author Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She's the president of Bennett College. Hi, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm great. Across the country, though, public and state universities are reporting anywhere from a 5 to 8% tuition increase for the upcoming year. Why is that?
Costs are rising. If you're running a college, you are looking at energy costs. You're looking at the same costs that the rest of the nation is looking at. And so people are raising tuitions to go along with that. Some of us are not. Bennett College's tuition has been stable for the last 3 years. We're not raising tuition this year. But many colleges are looking at the costs and saying we've got to meet it. In addition, frankly, there have been years where colleges have not raised costs. And now people are trying to catch up. In some state universities, people have not seen raises in 2 or 3 years. They've seen pay freezes. And so now we're trying to catch up. Lots of people are trying to catch up.
But what does that mean? For a college to catch up, a lot of students, first of all, just don't have any income, period. Secondly, if they are working part time, they often aren't making nearly enough to actually pay the freight. Does this mean that students end up taking out a greater burden of loans?
You're raising the right questions, Farai. It absolutely does. What it means is that if colleges try to catch up, then they raise tuition and students have to pay for it. And of course, we're looking at an economy that is flat, if not falling. You know, the R word keeps coming up. Are we in a recession or not? We're looking at any number of things for students. And it means that students are being faced with more debt to take on, more costs to bear. At the biggest schools with the greatest endowments, I mean, Harvard and Yale and Princeton are saying, if you're poor, we'll take you. You don't have to pay anything. But most schools can't do that. So we're looking at really a challenge for young people. If you want to make yourself more competitive, you got to get a college education. And we know the data says that if you get a college education, you're likely to make over the course of your life about $1 million more than you would if you didn't. But the flip side is, how much debt are you going to be shackled with?
Tell us about historically black colleges and universities. You mentioned that Bennett, your school, has not raised costs, but how much is tuition and how does that fall in the range of HBCUs?
Well, Bennett College's tuition is $21,300. That's tuition, room, and board for a year. That's the same as it was last year. And the year before that, I think we went up by about 5%. Most historically black colleges have tuitions that are lower than other private colleges. We attempt to deal with our students where they are. I will tell you that 92% of my students receive financial aid. Nearly half are first generation. So when you look at that, it does not behoove us to raise tuition at this time, even though we have the same rising gas prices, the same rising food prices, the same inflation that everyone else is experiencing. But HBCUs are a bargain for Rye. We are a bargain for young people. And the other thing we know is that we meet young people where they are. We take them to where they need to be. We work intensely with our young people. But at the same time, we really do understand that this proposition called higher education is becoming unaffordable for many people. And we really need to work on ways to make sure that every student who has the desire and the ability has the opportunity to have access to higher education.
When you think about the budget cuts, for example, in many states, which are affecting the cost of public higher education, what kind of ripple effects do you think that will have in the country if basically people are priced out of going to college?
Some young people will go to community college as opposed to going to a four-year institution. Some will just sit out and say, I'm not going to be able to do it. Parents are using their home equity And, you know, with the mortgage crisis that we have right now, there's less home equity to use. Some folks are looking at some parents dedicated to their young people's success are actually raiding their retirement accounts, which is something that many financial analysts, myself included, do not advise. However, if you want to look ahead, the question is how you do it. Community college. But there's another thing. There's a young woman out of Louisiana who wrote a book called How to Get Money for College. She was about a 3-point student at a Louisiana high school. She found over $100,000 by just working it, by just going in and looking for those grants, those loans, those other things. UNCF.com. The United Negro College Fund has lots of money available. You've got to apply for it. And my experience in the past year as president of Bennett reminds me to tell students, you've got to be aggressive. We're going to meet you halfway, but get aggressive. Your church has money. Your mother's sorority has money. Your dad's lodge has money. Just get aggressive because you've got to bring it. You really got to bring it.
Is it worth it? And what I mean by that is that, you know, we've talked a bit about whether or not in some cases grad school is worth it. But if you walk out of college with $80,000 in loans, which can happen, is it worth the cost?
Well, if you don't go to college and you end up with $1 million less in lifetime income, what do you think? I mean, certainly it's hard, and certainly there are lots of possibilities that young people have around coming out with $80,000 worth of debt. Much of that debt can be negotiated, but the fact is that we know that if you have a college degree, you're going to earn more than someone who didn't. And so, yeah, it's worth it. It's snarly. We need to change public policy for Rye so that young people who want to matriculate and want to excel and want to have access should have it. But before we change public policy, any young person who wants to go to college, if you have to take a loan, I think it's worth it.
There are a lot of people who go to college and they want to study something, and that something does not seem to have very much earnings potential. And people like parents say, do something else. If you have a passion that doesn't seem to have a high earnings potential, what would you, as someone who's the president of a university, say? Pursue your passion or go for something more practical?
I say do a combination. Pursue your passion, absolutely, but have a fallback plan. I always tell people have plan A, B, C, D, and E. You want to be a writer, go for it. But meanwhile, can you be an English teacher on the side? You know, I think of Sadie Tanner Moselle Alexander, who was the first black woman to get a PhD in economics. She got it from the University of Pennsylvania. She was not able to find a job pursuing her passion. And so she ended up going back to get a law degree. And she contributed mightily to the study of law and mightily to her sorority and mine, Delta Sigma Theta, mightily to many things. She didn't get her first choice, but she got another choice. So I always tell people, look at your many choices. Don't close any doors. But the fact is that, you know, take your passion and take it as far as you can, but understand you've got to make a living and you got to pay the loan back.
What about people like you who are college presidents? What challenges are you facing in trying to make sure that you can get a broad variety of students from different backgrounds?
Fry, you know, what keeps me up at night is the young women who want to be at Bennett but don't have the dollars, the young women who are students, who are continuing, who are saying, I need more financial aid, the young women whose parents can't take out another loan. That literally keeps me up at night. If you see me again and I'm gray, that's what did it. I wake up in the middle of the night saying, how can I find money for these young people? It is a challenge. We want every brain to work and to be fully engaged. And we know that college education provides opportunity for so many people. But at the same time, the dollars are not there. We've got to raise the dollars. I've got 104 peers, HBCU presidents, and we're all doing the same thing, trying to raise money to make sure that our students come into the world with as little debt as we can provide for them. We're trying to get our friends and our colleagues and our comrades to say, I'm going to invest in this college. It is so daunting when I think about how we've gone in 20, 30 years and how few opportunities our young people have. And so all I can do is work hard, beg hard, you know, ask for people to invest in our young people. But that literally is what keeps me up at night.
So who are your allies in trying to make sure that young people have a place to go?
I think there are many members of the Congressional Black Caucus and other congressional members who are looking at the Higher Education Act and trying to raise the amount of the Pell and other things. Those are allies. I think we have corporate friends who, if the case is made properly, will invest. I think they're individuals. They're high net worth African Americans who will invest. And I think there are lots of other people. Someone saw me on CNN the other day and sent me $25. And said, this should go to a student. And it both broke my heart and gave me wings because it meant that there was somebody who was watching and listening and learning and hoping that we can invest in the next generation.
Dr. Malveaux, thank you.
Thank you.
Julianne Malveaux is an economist, author, and president of Bennett College. She joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's Bloggers Roundtable, Senator Barack Obama goes to Iraq and meets with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. A women's bloggers conference asked the two potential first ladies to join in the online fun. And with us to discuss that today, we've got Robert Redding, the publisher of ReddingNewsReview.com, Jasmine Kanick, who blogs at JasmineKanick.com, and Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yersick, who blogs at AfroBella.com. Hi, folks. How you doing?
Hi.
Hi.
So let's start out with Obama. Barack Obama met with Iraq's prime minister today, and they discussed options for pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq. The Illinois senator is also set to meet with General David Petraeus and other top U.S. military officials. Senator McCain says this trip will show Obama was wrong to oppose the surge. Now, Robert, how do you see McCain using Obama's trip? Is it going to work to use this as a case to say, you know what, you were wrong on Iraq?
Well, I think that he might have some leverage there, but it's a negligible amount. People really view Barack as being more of a domestic guy. I think that's where his strength is, not in international politics. I think, you know, I'm kind of one of those folks that actually believes that, you know, the international sphere is great, but the problem is, and they have the experience there with McCain, which he obviously has, is irrefutable. Even Barack Obama says he's a war hero, but I think that he can concede some ground here in saying and turning around, look, I can get this country back where it needs to be domestically. That's my strength as President of the United States. And in addition to that, you know, we all have situations where we've had presidents that we've seen that have to grow in the international sphere, and he's going to have some growing pains, but I think he'll be fine.
But Jasmine, don't you think that if he's just fighting, he being Senator Obama, on domestic ground, that clearly he thinks that having some kind of a international policy reputation is important, or he wouldn't be there. Do you think he can fight on a political level on foreign policy, or is McCain just hands down the winner on that one?
No, McCain is not hands down the winner on anything. I think, as the other, earlier person stated, you know, we've had presidents who have strengths in different areas, which is not to say that Obama cannot grow strong in international relations. I think it's important to also acknowledge the fact that Obama is keenly aware that our reputation, our image internationally is very important. And I think he is key to changing our image. When we go abroad as an African American, I'm not seen as African-American. I'm seen as an American, and then therefore, i.e. Bush. And so I think that's also key and also very important. And also, let's remember, you know, McCain's not going to be happy. His camp isn't going to be happy with anything. They challenged Obama to go. They said he hadn't been. Now he's over there, and now they're still talking stuff. So either way it goes, they're not going to be happy.
Patrice, Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki has said he agrees with some aspects of Obama's troop withdrawal plan. McCain says what he knows what he wants, what Iraqis want better. He said, quote, and this is McCain, "I've been there too many times, I've met too many times with him, and I know what they want." Do you think any Americans really know what the Iraqis want? Do you think the Iraqis, who are very diverse in their opinion, even know what they want?
I think, I mean, there's a lot of figuring out to do, and I mean, I don't think making a statement like, "I know what they want," I think that goes in line with what this government has been doing the whole time, pretty much. So I'm sure, I wonder how Iraqi people would respond to that. I think Obama's move is a clever preemptive move. It makes McCain have to switch up his criticism, and it proves that Obama is kind of the same candidate of change that he's been presenting himself as. He's willing to learn, he's willing to meet with people who oppose his opinion, and I think it strengthens him as a candidate all around.
Well, Robert, one last thing before we move on. Senator Obama said he wants to shift the focus of the war to Afghanistan and increase troops there. Afghanistan has been a bit on the back burner compared to Iraq, although it was the original site of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Do you think it's a good idea to really reinvest in Afghanistan?
Well, in light to the fact that we have a resurgence in the Taliban there, we have a situation where the prisons were compromised by the Taliban and some members escaped. I think that Afghanistan is key to capturing Osama bin Laden. In addition to that, if I can go back to something I said really quickly earlier, I think one of the panelists is right in terms of Barack Obama being who he is, a black man, or one who would, a person who identifies as being a black man across and abroad, that will change our image. But that's about as far as it goes. I just don't think he has the international profile yet. But I think he'll get that.
Patrice, this is a very different topic. We're talking about AKA. It's the oldest black sorority, turned 100 last week. Alpha Kappa Alpha is celebrating, or was celebrating, in Washington, D.C. Mattel even released a Barbie doll in the image of the sorority, and Michelle Obama accepted a non-exclusive honorary membership. 200,000 members worldwide. It has, a lot of social outreach in terms of doing good works in the community. Do you think it has political sway?
What do you mean, the sorority?
The sorority as a body. Do you think it has any political...
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's just that Michelle Obama is willing to put herself out there and accept their invitation to join. I think it says that, you know, it's the history of this country. It's changing, and the fact that Barbie, which is an institution unto itself, is willing to recognize that and to create a doll in this image, and it proves that we've come a long way. And I think that this organization definitely does have some political sway.
But Jasmine, I'm thinking of Spike Lee. He really spoofed all black fraternities and sororities in the film School Days.
My favorite film.
And this sorority was pegged as light-skinned,
the
long-haired.
Wannabes. Light and bright.
The wannabes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is there any truth to these stereotypes, or at least to the cliquishness that can happen on campuses?
Absolutely. I mean, but it's not, Jermaine, just the sororities and fraternities. There's cliques, period, on campus and even in our, you know, everyday adult lives. You know, back to the original question of whether or not, you know, this group can have sort of some political power influence, I think anytime you get a group, especially a group that large, you said 200,000, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I would probably go so far as to say most of those women are probably registered voters and those women will vote. I just, mm-hmm. you know, my stomach turned just a little bit at the idea of the Barbie thing. I'm just very uncomfortable with that. I, you know, you think back on the whole black doll thing versus the white doll. And, you know, here comes Mattel with this Barbie for the, I just, you know, I'm not down with that.
Robert, what do you think of the, in general, of the political power of black fraternities and sororities? First of all, do they have any? And secondly, if they have these large memberships, are they doing enough outreach on a political level?
In the sheer numbers, of course, they have political influence. Have they exercised it all the time? No, and I don't think there has been a compelling reason to for the most part, on a national spectrum. We'll see a lot more of that with Barack, clearly. But I, you know, the thing about it is, too, I looked at the Mattel story, the Barbie story, and I thought that it was good that we were putting a doll out there that helps the image of black women being beautiful, beautiful sisters that they are. I didn't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah, well, you're a guy.
But I'm not attracted to Barbie dolls.
Oh boy!
Well, does the Barbie
have
an
different
afro?
Type of
that's
fetish.
All I want to know. Does she come with locks? Does she come with afros? Is there, or does she just have straight wavy hair with red lips?
No, I've seen some criticism of the Barbie for that reason because she does kind of reinforce those typical appearances.
Get your relaxer.
Well,
get
maybe
your
if you put her underwater, it puffs out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm joking.
You guys,
I am joking.
You guys are a mess. In case you're just tuning in, this is the Bloggers Roundtable of NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we were just hearing about Barbie dolls from Robert Redding, the publisher of ReddingNewsReview.com.
Don't put that on me.
Jasmine Canik, who blogs at JasmineCanik.com, and Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yursik, who blogs at AfroBella.com. All right, more on Michelle Obama. She joined your ranks in the blogosphere last week. The women's bloggers group and conference called Blog Her invited Obama to blog, and she did. They also invited Cindy McCain to begin posting, an offer that she has yet to accept. So, Jasmine, the headline of Obama's post was "Let's Talk," and she wrote in part, "I'll be honest, when Barack first told me he was thinking about running for president, I had mixed feelings. I worried about my girls and what a campaign might do to their lives." But her blog post was really long. How would you rate it?
Yeah. Well, I can't rate it because I haven't read it yet, you know. Well,
that's a demerit, you know, for you.
It is a demerit, but, you know, I have a life. I'm working. But you know what I will say, just on the strength that, A, she did accept it. And, you know, that's one of the things I love the most about Michelle, is that she's very out there. She's willing to do things on behalf of this campaign. And she's always said that her family comes first and that those are the most important issues for her. And I appreciate that. You know, I'm a little concerned, like, why, you know, Ms. McCain wouldn't blog. I mean, anything that you can do to help your man, help your candidate, you should be willing to do. And I think that's one of the things that sets Michelle apart. I think that's also one of the reasons why she is hated by a lot of people, because she is out there and she is loved so much. But they have to look at the situation. I mean, in my opinion, she goes far and above what McCain's wife does in terms of her public image, her publicity, what she's willing to get out there and do. And I think this is another classic example.
Patrice, it sounds like you did take a look at it.
Oh, yeah, I did. I mean, it was a very long post. Just from a blogger's perspective, I might have broken that up into two or three different topics so she'd have more to talk about the next time. Or at least put, like, a more tag, you know, because it was pretty long. But I thought it was, you know, I'm an unabashed fan of the Obama family, and I love Michelle, I really do. And I really think that it's admirable that she's opening herself up this way and communicating with potential voters. One of the things that I enjoyed about reading the blog was that when I scrolled down to the bottom, comments were open. I was kind of expecting it to be closed comments, you know, like to regulate what people might say to her. I don't know if she's actually reading them or if she's going to wade in and respond to what people have to say, but I like the fact that she's proving that, hey, you know, this is a new, fresh kind of voice, and I'm here to listen as well as to speak.
Robert, do you think that at this point in time that something like this will be seen as legitimate blogging? I mean, it's, you know, that's such a weird term, but I guess grassroots blogging or just a publicity stunt?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but I think that it's good. I think that Michelle Obama, everybody talks about Barack Obama being the next Kennedy or another Kennedy, or, you know, kind of Kennedy all over again, and hopefully it doesn't end as badly as the first Kennedy. Mm-hmm. But let me just say that I think Michelle, enough can't be said about her being kind of like the black Jackie. I think she's a phenomenal person. I think she's got a lot more to say, so I don't think she'll have any problem with future blogs. And let me just also add that I did the cover article for Upscale Magazine on Michelle Obama, which hits stands today, ironically.
Well, congratulations on that. We'll check it out. Moving on to yet another political topic. Oh, there is so much. New York Governor Patterson railed at the press from his NAACP pulpit last week. He implied racism when he was labeled the accidental governor. He said nobody called Teddy Roosevelt an accidental president. No one called Truman an accidental president. And nobody called LBJ an accidental anything. So, Robert, do you think that he has a point?
Well, I don't. I haven't decided that yet. I'm familiar with what happened, but I'm just not sure whether I can't say one way or the other on that one.
Jasmine, what
I hate to. I'm going to pull up on that one.
You know what? I kind of have to agree. I'm not feeling it right now. I mean, I don't have too many thoughts on it. I'm familiar with everything that happened, but that wasn't one of the things that crossed my mind.
I see where he was coming from, kind of. I think the fact that in that same, I mean, there was an article in the New York Sun, the fact that the term has been used before, because he was saying it was never used before, and they were able to prove that it was used several times, it kind of took a little bit of the wind out of his argument. I mean, he's right that black politicians are put under a different kind of scrutiny,
true,
and there is subtle phrasing of the criticism, but, I mean, I think that that particular argument maybe not, it doesn't strengthen what he was trying to say.
All right. That's a unanimous vote from the panel. All right. One last thing. Star Jones's soon-to-be ex-husband, Al Reynolds, gushed in an interview posted on his YouTube page that he still loves The View host. She handed him divorce papers back in February, but he still wears a ring. Let's listen.
I still wear my ring. It hasn't settled in yet. I still love her.
Are you heartbroken?
You can't be heartbroken. Every lesson that you learn in life is for a reason. Does the heart hurt? Yes, it does. Right now, it's just a little tender. Our relationship is a little tender, and hopefully over time, we can heal a lot of that.
So, yes, this is the husband, ex-husband soon to be, of the ex-View host. He's also denying rumors that he's gay, which seem to come up quite a lot. He says he just likes to pay attention to his appearance. What do you make of this member of the black celebrity pantheon, Jasmine?
You know, it's just funny to me. But I guess what I will say is that, you know, President Clinton said he didn't have sex with that woman, and we know how that ended up. So,
but Patrice, why? I mean, you know, they are so fascinating as a couple to so many people.
That's one way of saying it.
A nice way of saying it.
I know.
Do you think they
cringeworthy.
Have? Yes. Do you think they have staying power as a sort of gossip couple, even if they're not a couple?
I mean, there's a lot of humor value in Star and Al, and there has been pretty much since they came out with the whole wedding and the endorsements. And I mean, people have been just kind of sitting back and waiting for this to happen anyway, you know. So he just makes me cringe. I don't know. He lives here in Miami. He's a regular on the social circuit, and I mean, that video is 12 minutes. I just wish I had back, you know. There's something so sleazy about him. I hate to be a hater, but it just was like he protests too much, and the gay thing, and I still love Star. I mean, I didn't think I had sympathy in my heart for Star Jones, but now I do.
No, don't have sympathy for Star. She lied about her bypass surgery, and I didn't appreciate that.
Mm-mm.
Wow. Well, on that note, guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Robert Redding, the publisher of ReddingNewsReview.com, Jasmine Canick, who blogs at jasminecanick.com. She joined us in our NPR West studios in Culver City, and Patrice Elizabeth Grell-Yursik, who blogs at afrobella.com, and she joined us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. You may not know who Verna Griffin is, but you probably know her son, rapper and music producer Andre Young, also known as Dr. Dre. He's the founding member of the rap group N.W.A., who made it big with a controversial album, Straight Outta Compton.
is his name, and the boy's coming.
Straight out of Compton, it's a brother that don't smoke your mother and make your sister think I love her. Dangerous young brother raising hell, and if I ever get caught, I'll make bail. See, I don't really care.
Before Dr. Dre's success, Verna survived an abusive childhood, dealt with domestic abuse, and married and divorced several times. Now she's given plenty of details about those struggles in a new memoir called Long Road Out of Compton. Verna, it is so good to have you in the studio with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Give me a moment from your childhood that you think really shaped you.
From the age of 2 to 9, I lived with a babysitter. And unfortunately, it was an abusive babysitter that beat me. And my mom, one day, she came by to visit, and she happened to see a scar. I used to hide them. And she asked, what was it? And I was reluctant to say. And then she asked me, well, who did that? And I, you know, told her that Miss Farley, my babysitter. And she and my babysitter had a little heated discussion that I went out on the porch because I didn't want to hear. The thing was, is that through my life, I've learned to make all my negatives into positives. So I turn back and I look at, most people say that, boy, I would have hated her. But I went back to see her. I went back to visit her, you know, and I forgave her for what she did. And think, if it had not been for you, maybe I wouldn't have, you know, maybe I don't know where I would have been.
And you were going ahead with your schooling and started dating. And by the time you had Dre, who is your first child, you were just 15, is that right?
I actually had just turned 16.
So you were 15 when you got pregnant, 16 when you had him.
My birthday was February 4th. He was born 2 weeks later, exactly February 18th. And so he was sort of like a birthday present, a little doll, you know, that's something you could undress and redress. And I just, you know, I learned, I read books, child psychology books, stuff, because I wanted to be a good mother and prove all these people wrong, that in the neighborhood you hear the little whispers, oh, she, look at her, she's not going to be nothing, and her child's not going to be nothing either. That's another negative that made me try harder and make it into a positive.
You have had several important men in your life who have been verbally or physically abusive to you, or both. What did it do to you to, not just once or twice, but several times, have these relationships that you cared about go in a direction where you weren't even feeling physically safe?
I think that it did make me stronger. Getting beat up by the first one, you know, it was like if he raised his hand to scratch his head, I was ducking because I'm thinking, you know, that here it comes, you know. I spent a lot of my time in the bedroom, and I just didn't want my child to be around that. And I would always keep my eye out the window and looking at strange cars and stuff parked across the street or down the street, thinking, you know, what happens if the police come and take everybody to jail and they take my child away?
It's not easy trying to hold it down financially while you've got kids. Your life now must be a little bit more comfortable than it was before.
A lot.
A lot more comfortable. What do you enjoy about some of the comforts you have now?
Oh, my God. It was at one time I used to say, if I didn't have all these bills, maybe I could do something. It was just seemingly that every little piece of money that I would get. And now I don't have a bill. I don't see a bill. I live in a wonderful, my son has put me in a beautiful home, in a beautiful community. Who could ask for anything more?
Did you ever worry about his safety? I mean,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
There were times that it was like Fred Sanford, you know, the big one. Oh, my God. You know, what is going to, Andre, are you going to be okay? Especially when he was in death row. That's when I did all my worrying. You're hearing, I didn't see things happening, but all these things you're hearing. And one morning I woke up and I had my radio on, and I wake up to Dr. Dre is being sought for stabbing a 17-year-old kid. And I was like, oh, my God. And first thing I thought, I don't know what, was to call Andre. And he's at home in his bed. And I said, well, Andre, I was like going, they're talking about you were on the, you were involved in this thing, you know. And he says, wasn't me. he said, Mom, you can't believe everything the media says. And I thought, I said, okay, I'm going to keep that thought. But how do I know when I should really be worrying? So it was a little scary.
You definitely have you have spirit. You have so much spirit. And I want to ask you about two things that must be among the hardest things that happened to you, and those are the deaths of your children. Tell us about those and how you dealt with that.
I have five children. I have my oldest, Andre, and my youngest, Shamika, who is 30. Now, I lost three boys. One died at 2 months old. We don't know what. They just labeled it something. He was healthy. And I woke up one morning and he was dead. That took a toll on me. Oh, my God. I could hear a baby crying in the distance. I started drinking, you know, trying to drown. It was a lot of things that, wow, that really took a toll. And I had one that died. He was only a day old. I delivered him prematurely. And the one that hurt, I think, the most was my son that got killed in 89. He was 21 years old and got killed by a gang member.
Yeah, your son, Tyree.
Yeah, but it was devastating. I thought I was a walking zombie half the time. And that's another thing. I thought that no one can tell me, you know, people were telling me go to therapy. And I'm thinking no strange person can tell me anything. You know, they probably got their problems themselves. But when things get too heavy, you do need to go and get some help. And it did help me. It did help. He'll never be forgotten. They will never be forgotten. Tyree was one that he was my funny person that would have me laughing when I felt down and out. He would come over and just say something that would just have me cracking up. And I think that my daughter kind of started filling those shoes, knowing that he used to make me laugh. Now it's her that makes me laugh all the time. When her and Andre get together, she and Andre gets together, it's hilarious. So we really bonded together through that time, and we were each other's rock, I think, trying to be strong for one another.
Well, Verna, it was so good talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Verna Griffin is the mother of rapper and producer Dr. Dre. She's got a new memoir, and it's called Long Road Out of Compton. You can watch video of this interview on our blog. Just go to nprnewsandviews.org. Last April, CNN started a series of special reports on the Black experience in America. The first episode of Black in America covered the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the end of the Civil Rights era. The next installment of the series is called The Black Woman and Family. It airs on Wednesday. Soledad O'Brien anchors the series, and she's with us now. Hey, how you doing?
Well, nice to talk to you.
Well, you know, one of the things that we as journalists do when we decide to do a story is ask, what's the central question? So what's the central question you're trying to get at with this series?
The central question is, what is it like to be Black in this country 40 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? What opportunities have been afforded us and what obstacles still remain in spite of many people's best efforts? So I think essentially that was the big question. A topic as big as this, you cannot answer all the questions that are out there, but that was probably the main one we were trying to answer.
So you hosted a panel discussion that aired on Saturday. It featured Julianne Malvo, Cornel West, T.D. Jakes, Ed Gordon, and Hill Harper.
Mm-hmm.
Does that discussion improve the lives of Black Americans? And what I mean by that is we talk a lot, you know, about these issues, sometimes privately, sometimes publicly. Do you think that a conversation like this will actually help improve how people lead their lives?
When you say that, you sound exactly like Professor Roland Fryer, who was also part of that panel, when he says, Soledad, I am a doer, I am a doer. And it's true. And so I think sometimes you do have to talk to make sure that everybody's on the same page and we know the things that then have to be done. So conversation isn't necessarily a useless thing. You know, and one of the things, I mean, there was actually a little bit of back and forth between Dr. Fryer and Dr. Malveau, because the two of them were sort of saying, you know, do you fight the problem now as it is, or do you, you know, work on policy changes and work to improve schools in a real way? And to see both of them sort of taking their side, which, of course, I think the answer is both. You do both. Dr. Fryer, you run and try to put out fires. You see today in his program where he's paying kids to learn. He is literally trying to figure out, how do I motivate kids today in these schools today who are in fourth grade today, so that by seventh grade, they are going to be successful. We don't see that achievement gap. And Dr. Malveau is saying, well, there are some big structural changes that paying kids to learn doesn't even begin to fix. So we need to also focus on making sure that there are services and there are books and there are good teachers and all those things that actually take a fair amount of time to get to. So in a lot of ways, yeah, I think talking is good, because talking can lead to doing. Talking that's useless, of course, and doesn't lead to any sort of productive action, then yeah, let's not do that.
And, of course, Dr. Malveau is one of our contributors.
I know she is.
Her at the top of the show, so yep. Always glad to see her on TV as well.
She said something to me that was stunning stunning and not stunning, I guess, at the same time, because she said, you know, Soledad, many people don't know this. Most black people will not commit a crime. Most black people will get up, they will go to their jobs, they will work at those jobs, they will get in their cars, they will come home, they will, you know, sit down, they will go to bed. They will not rob anybody, they will not do any crimes, and yet the picture we see in America of black people is not that. And the way she put it so succinctly, it really was the first time I'd heard anybody say it just like that. And it was perfect. I mean, to me, it was like, yes, exactly. Where are those people in mainstream media? Where are that vast middle class of people who are woefully underrepresented? That's part of our story.
Well, I want to go to your segment, The Black Woman and Family. Here is your sit-down interview with single mom Ira Johnson.
How hard has it been to be a single mom to five kids who are all teenagers?
Sometimes it just gets, I can't deal with the kids. See how he do his mama?
Ira struggles to provide for her large family, working two jobs as a real estate agent and a licensed massage therapist.
I can't stop. I push myself more now than I ever have. There's times that, especially the summertime, I didn't come home until like 8 o'clock at night sometimes.
So what did you learn from talking to her?
What was the amazing thing was, here's a woman who is literally working around the clock to try to provide a better life for her kids, and yet she's not there, which means that when her son gets in trouble, legal trouble, it sends her into this tailspin because she can't afford to pay for his lawyer. And she understands that if he does not get good representation as a young black man, there's a very good chance that he's going to be shunted into a prison system. And to watch Ira try to figure out, and you know, she's in this very delicately built house of cards, and as a single woman who, four of those children she had, and then one is her sister she brought into the family, you know, she's always on the edge. In the middle of our document, we're shooting with her, someone knocks on the door and they're evicting her out of her home. As hard as she works, it is just a struggle to keep it up. So, you know, and it brings you, you know, all these stories are not in a vacuum. Poverty and lack of fathers in the home and crime and drug use and shunting people into prison, those are all concentric circles. You know, they can't be resolved just one at a time. They have to sort of be all approached at the same time. You know, she's an amazing woman because she's so strong and she's has such a great heart and she does not give up. But sometimes the fact that the way she's going about it works against her.
What were the upsides that you found as you did specifically The Black Woman and Family? What sorts of traits or life patterns did you find that actually work for black women?
Well, some of the statistics were that, you know, the black middle class is growing, that certainly black women are, you know, I mean, you just have to walk around Dr. Malveau's campus to see the number of young black women who are in school and engaged and smart. I got a chance to actually address some of her students when I was there talking to her. So for black women are doing really well, certainly when compared to black men. And in our polls, too, we see that there's a certain optimism that black women have and black people have about the situation for black women that does not exist for black men. And then even that, again, doesn't live in a vacuum because it weighs in on the relationship between black men and black women if they are achieving at unequal rates? You know, what does that do back to the family? What does that do back to relationships? So, you know, there are some great hopeful signs and then also some real concerning signs.
Just briefly, what is this moment in time to blackness as we see, of course, the political arena unfolding? What kind of time are we living in?
It's a time of change, but I think that someone asked me, they said, Spike Lee says, when Barack Obama is elected president, everything will change the next day. I said, I don't think so. Said with much love to Spike, but it's like turning the Titanic. And I don't know if Barack Obama is going to be elected the next president or not. But I'll tell you this, change is slow. Change is a turning of a big ship. So I think that we're at a time when we're beginning to feel like there's a ship turning because people are engaged in a discussion about race. Really, for having been a journalist now, this is my 21st year. I mean, I've been in a long time, and it's the first time I've really felt. A lot of that is Barack Obama's presence in the race. People are having these dialogues that are on the front page of the New York Times about race that we have not had. Regular folks want to talk to me about Barack Obama and being biracial. You know, people I've known for years, suddenly we're having these intense conversations about the fact that I'm biracial. So to me, it is the turning of the Titanic that begins with a thoughtful discussion. And if we can contribute to that thoughtful discussion in any way, then I'm very proud of that.
Well, Soledad, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Soledad O'Brien is anchoring a series of documentaries and special reports for CNN called Black in America. The next installment of the series airs on Wednesday night. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.